Welcome to the No Film School podcast. This is Gigi Hawkins, and I am a cord cutter, or maybe even a cord never. I've never paid for cable TV, and I think it's very easy to sort of skip over the importance of, you know, the millions of people who are watching broadcast and cable networks here in the United States. I was listening to an episode of Talk Easy with Quinta Brunson, great podcast, highly, highly recommend it, hosted by Sam Fragoso. And she was speaking about Abbott Elementary being made for her family, you know, an audience that isn't watching Succession as the rest of us who are, you know, deep in the industry and deeply cynical about the world are. And I recently had a sort of reconnection with broadcast in watching Quantum Leap, which I had seen all the promotion for, but I hadn't really dipped my toe in. And I came across this episode called The Family Treasure, which came out earlier in February of this year, featuring Dean, a character who comes out to their siblings as non-binary during the episode. And I learned more about the writer of the episode, Shakina, who is a performer, writer, producer, director, and activist, and wanted to hear more about how this came to be. And in watching the episode, I was like, oh my gosh, I love this show. This is like the vibe I want in the world. It's an adventure. This particular episode was like a huge callback to Indiana Jones. There's this nostalgia narrative. There was just like, it was like a feel-good thing. And I was like, oh, this is what the world needs. Don't get me wrong. I love Succession, but I need something to balance out my media diet. So in sitting down with Shakina, we talked about a lot of the sort of nuts and bolts mechanics of writing a show for broadcast. And this episode is a really good place to start if you're at all interested in working in this space, but it's also a great refresher if you sort of stick to the auteur or horror or things outside of it, because I think there are still a lot of good takeaways about working within production. So in our conversation, we talk about finding and maintaining a consistent tone and ethos for a show like this. We talk about how to advocate for yourself within a production and create more opportunities for yourself. We also talk about the evolution of queer narratives and how to be an ally within this space. And we really get to the heart of, you know, storytelling, how characters and stakes and people we care about can carry you through, whether you're dropped into a show like this, as broadcast is also designed, or if you're the audience that tunes in every single week. It's kind of amazing how these very just human-driven, human-connecting stories will get you invested almost instantly. And we talk a lot about how if you do that work up front, you get your audience on board. And now here's my interview with Shakina.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, You want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome, Shakina, to the No Film School podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Gigi, I'm so happy to be with you.
I feel like we talked to a lot of film directors and people who are in the feature space, but it's always exciting to speak to somebody who is working in the episodic space. And you have worn all the hats. You have been in pretty much every position that you can, it feels like. I mean, tell me if you were holding a boom mic ever, but it is going to be so valuable to hear about your experience across the board working in television. So I'm so excited to speak with you. And let's just get started. How did you get your start as a storyteller?
Well, I think I got my start as a storyteller doing like queer trans performance art, kind of like beginning in the drag space, but then more toward the unconventional avant-garde, which then led me in a lot of really wild directions. But at the core, I was also like a musical theater lover, like a Broadway girl. And so I found a kind of eventual harmony, like a place to land as a storyteller in alt cabaret spaces, sort of like stand-up comedy, meet spoken word, meet musical theater, and like really raunchy underground, you know, and also classy supper clubs in New York City, you know, it goes across the board. But that's really where I kind of like shaped myself as a storyteller. And then I didn't transition into television until after I transitioned. And then I booked my first role as an actor on Difficult People on Hulu, playing Lola. And that was sort of my like breakthrough moment. I had been like pounding the pavement as a director and a performer for a long time, but that was in 2016. And that's what sort of like got me in.
What was the biggest sort of adjustment that you had to make moving from the stage and musical theater and cabaret and all of these sort of like spaces that require you to be big and larger than life, and bringing that down to be still full of life, but in front of the camera? What was the biggest like a change that you had to make?
I think the scale is really the thing. I think I've always been a fan of capturing intimacy in performance, whether that's like through spectacle or through something really close. And so it was just about learning how to contain it in the frame, you know, which as a theater director and a performer, like I'm always building frames for all my stories, you know, and framing is a really important device. And that comes through in what you're doing when you're thinking about working for the camera in front of or behind it.
That's something that I've like never thought about, like the frame on the stage, but it totally makes sense. And it's sort of like a way to contextualize what you're doing. What's interesting is, you know, I feel like it's been a while since I've watched a network TV show, and I like tapped into Quantum Leap, which I saw like all this promoting for, and I knew it was a reboot of something, but it's such an interesting device to think about framing, because every episode has this element of going back in time, but then you're sort of framing it within the context of everything. And actually, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that and sort of how you got into like the... what it's like being in this type of space, like being in the writer's room. Yeah. You've been the director, you've been in front of the camera, but like, how do you think about framing in that context?
Well, it's such a wild, like fortuitous ride that brought me here. But I remember my first general meeting at NBC Universal after I booked Difficult People. And you're sitting in these meetings and they want to like, you know, pin you down and know who you are and like in a sentence. And I thought I was being all brilliant. And I was like, well, I think my greatest currency is my ability to transform. So I want to conquer every genre, which is like very true to who I am as a storyteller. And then as soon as I said that, I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to work in this town again. Like they wanted me to be like, I'm your sitcom queen, or like, I got your procedurals, or like whatever.
Yeah.
And here I am like, no, I want to do literally everything in my own way. And then after Connecting, which was the show that we did during the pandemic, which was sort of like you said, we'll talk about it later, but it was a big kind of turning point in my career. I met Martin Jarrow, who's the creator of that show, who's also the EP and showrunner of this Quantum Leap sequel. So we were developing something independently that was sort of like inspired by my life. And that's still kicking around. But in the meantime, everyone was like, you should probably get in a writer's room and see how that works. And so when it was announced that Quantum Leap would be happening, I reached out and I was like, hey, do you think you could, like, at the time, Martin wasn't show running. And I was like, do you think if I got a sample together, could you, like, you know, set me up for an interview? And like, or he's like, I can send them your sample. Okay, great. So I wrote a sample, like, never having written in genre before, and just sort of like put it all out there. A dear friend of mine, Shady Potosky, is another trans TV writer, was like, just write something that'll never get made. So yeah. I did. And nice. Then I got an interview and I got the job. And basically I was like, look, I could pitch you an episode about trans kids in sports, which I did. But I also was like, I can tell you that I know what it's like as a trans person to walk in someone else's shoes, because I had to do it my whole life. And that is an insight I can bring to this particular time traveling character who inhabits other people. And so lo and behold, I end up with a job in a writer's room where week to week, I get to be a part of conquering every genre, because amazing. Quantum Leap goes back in time and tells that these stories that, you know, set right what once went wrong. And we do it through the lens, literally and figuratively, of these sort of like canonical, you know, tropes of storytelling and cinema and television. And we get to have our, you know, teen sports episode and our treasure hunt episode and our Towering Inferno episode. And, you know, it yeah. So it all kind of worked. I get to conquer every genre with Quantum Leap.
That's incredible.
Like, wild how it all came together.
I love that. You're like, I pitched myself as the wrong thing for this industry. And then it was like, this thing came in. It was perfect. Was Indiana Jones an influence for this episode?
100%. Yes.
I
so
love that.
Yeah. We came back from the strike and we had no time to put together a new script, because I had written something pre-strike for that slot that was way too big for what we could afford to do at the time. We had a big musical episode in the works, and maybe we will.
That'll happen in the future.
Yeah. But in the meantime, we had no time to come up with something new. And Dean Jagaris and Martin Garrow pitched me. They were like, we need something like Romancing the Stone. Can you bring us something that's like just a treasure hunt, but like maybe there's a non-binary storyline.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, challenge met. And so, of course, for me, it was actually the original title of the episode that I was Bediana Jones, because I wanted to invoke, like, not just Indiana Jones, but that whole treasure hunt genre, and like, more than the genre, like the nostalgia that we all feel in our hearts when we experience those narratives. And then Jude Wang, who came in to direct, was a huge Indiana Jones fan, had directed Finding Ohana, which is an incredible, like, treasure hunt in Hawaii. And so she just got it. And yeah, we got to make a treasure hunt with like a sort of trans mass non-binary, you know, young little hero. And
yeah,
that's just what the world needs.
Totally. The thing that struck me was how quickly I was with these characters. And I know we have tell me if this is the structure of the show. We have the recurring characters. And I think Ben is the protagonist who goes back in time and is helping solve these mysteries. And so there's this story within the story. Each of the characters from the past, are they new characters every time?
Every week. So we have this like headquarters of Quantum Leap, with an incredible series regular cast who work sort of as a procedural story engine, checking in on, they have their own sort of character journeys that we're following throughout the season, but they're really all there to sort of work to help bring Ben back, because he left and is something we're not able to bring him home. So every week he leaps into someone else's body, and someone in that person's life is having some kind of crisis moment that Ben has to, you know, help set right. And then that's what enables him to leap again.
Yeah.
So we get these new setups every week where we have this sort of like human story that's so deeply personal, and someone's life is being saved or changed, and it's completely new guest star cast every week. So we get these incredible performers in to sort of like have like this, like, and they're really they're the stars of the episode, you know.
Yeah.
Raymond Lee Ben is the protagonist. He's the star of the show. But every episode has these great, you know, self-contained stories that we crack together in the room, and then we string them together over the course of the season.
I think the biggest thing that struck me was how invested I was in both the recurring characters, but these guest stars immediately. And so I'm curious, it felt like Dean's story, and that's within this story, But how, as storytellers and within the room, how do you get people invested in these characters almost instantly? Like, what are the tools to like get right to that lava of like, I care about the stakes and I care about these people?
Yeah, we work really hard to, in the teaser, in the first like 5 pages of the episode, 3 to 5 pages, know who we are and what world we're in and what that person like wants or needs or might be facing. So in the realization of like where Ben is and in any leap week to week, we as the writers have to sort of figure out, okay, what information do we have to get across right away to make sure these characters are deeply felt and relatable, and that we want to go on an adventure with them, that we have like a sort of a, you know, a point of attraction to whatever it is that they're going through. And yeah. And then, you know, we kind of set them up and knock them down. It unfolds differently every time, but we always make sure that in our sort of like 5-act structure plus a teaser in our writing, that we have these, what, you know, what we call page turns and act outs. So you want to think at the end of every script, and this might be old news for your listeners, but like you, it's the same in every case. You just want to make sure that like you want to keep going. You want to keep watching, like the drama increases, the stakes increase. And I think because we're really telling these human stories that are about families and people going through, like, you know, even if it's a sort of like spectacular scenario, I keep coming back to our finale for the season that's going to happen tonight. And it's just like the setup is so huge, but the story is so intimate, you know? Yes. And I think that's what makes Quantum Leap so special, is because it's like really a heartfelt, you know, saga, like week to week.
It's interesting. I think that one of the reasons that I connected, there are a couple of reasons that I connected, but I think there's like my entry point into this particular story was, this reminds me, or this feels familiar. This reminds me of Temple of Doom, because that was the one VHS of the Indiana Jones series I owned and watched again and again as a kid. And I will argue that it's the best because, you know, it's close to home. And then on top of it, it was a deeply intimate and personal story. And I mentioned this before on the podcast, but my sister is trans, and I think that this is one of those things where like, I wish that my family had seen this, or this had been sort of part of the conversation as we were growing up, something to model what this conversation could be like, coming out to your family or coming out, and how can you sort of be there to support? So I'd love to talk about, spoiler, the moment where Dean like comes out as non-binary to their sister, and then also how Ben plays a sort of conduit to modern language used to, you know, create the space where they're like kind of exploring and being like, oh, this is how this works. I'd love to unpack that scene in particular.
Yeah, it's really meta. I mean, just a brief recap for your audiences, these siblings get their father dies, leaving them a treasure map, and they have to put the pieces together and follow the clues and go on a treasure hunt in Mexico. And along the way, one of the younger siblings, who is like already sort of really presenting gender nonconforming and what we call an episode transmasculine, like they have a coming out scene that's really powerful, where they've sort of survived a cave-in, and their shirt's torn to shreds, and they like stand up, and you can see that they're wearing a binder, and they take off their torn shirt, and they're like, you know, just this James Dean like silhouetted in the in the sun, like non-binary transmasc hero moment, saying this is who I am, which reclaims a lot of tropes in trans representation, especially transmasc representation, I think, in terms of you know, just showcasing this as a powerful choice to define oneself and express oneself. And of course, it's in the 1950s, I should have mentioned, so this is very radical. And this character, you know, says, this is who I am, but I wish I had better words to explain myself. And Ben, who is our time traveler, happens to have, back in HQ, a bestie in the character Ian, played by Mason Aller Park, an incredible non-binary actor, incredible actor who is also non-binary. And so in the first season, I did this episode where Ben really learns how to be an accomplice to a trans girl on a basketball team, who he finds out is his daughter, and he's the coach of her team, and it's a great journey. Please watch episode, I think it's 112.
112.
Yeah, 112. Done. Let them play. But so Ben learns how to be an accomplice in that episode. And so in season two, we get to this critical moment. And the character of Jen, who works with Ian in HQ, is like, do you want to tap in? Do you want to go leap in and solve this problem and take it off Ben's hands? And instead, you know, Ben has the ability to say, hey, I have this best friend back in finishing school, because that's the sort of metaphor that we're popping back to, because he's leaped into the body of like a teenage girl. Yeah. In the 50s. And he's like, I have this best friend back in finishing school who doesn't feel like he or she really works for them. And so they use they, them pronouns, which is like really non-binary, introducing a whole new word to this kid in the 50s who's trying to understand themselves. And so in so doing, gives them another option, another word, some language. Mm-hmm. And in it all, like you said, this conversation sort of models what's possible with coming out and with supporting gender expression and exploration. But also it sort of does in a sort of meta way what the episode is doing, which is like, it's really like a missive. Like, I talk about my work like a Care Bear stare. I'm just like blasting out, like, please let the children see it. Like, please let the families watch it that need to watch it, so that they have some of that language. And it's like, oh, you know, Wilder Yari, who plays Dean, you know, says, you know, thank you for listening to me when I tell you who I am. Which is like, I'm rewriting my own history. You know, when I wrote that line, I'm giving myself and every like young trans kid, like the experience that, you know, the wish fulfillment, which is what we go for every week in Quantum Leap, you know, the wish fulfillment of being seen and understood and accepted. And that makes it possible, like out in the world, and especially through network television, which is like in some ways, like a last pocket of access to certain, you know, communities that aren't tuning into streaming and aren't tuning into places where there might be more trans representation as a given. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, it feels like, you know, one small leap and then also like a huge thing.
Yes. So, it's so exciting. And it's so exciting that it's sort of like, it's not, this actually brings me to a very specific question, and I might contextualize it in your story. But I'm curious how you're seeing sort of like queer coming out stories in the media evolve. And let's start with the fact that you made TV history as the first transgender person to be cast as a series regular on a network sitcom. And this was also an NBC series called Connecting. So like, you know, you stepped into that role at a very specific time. And here we are now. Like, how is that shifting? How is that changing?
Well, you know, it takes a village. So I am one, you know, trans person who happens to be both an activist and a performer, writer, creator, storyteller. And there are many of us. And there are also many of us who are activists and not creative writer, storyteller, performers. And also there are people who are performers and storytellers who don't consider themselves activists. So it's important to just, you know, the Venn diagram is broad. And then there's a particular intersection of us who I think have been consistently working to push the needle forward. And that involves creating and also advocating. And that, you know, I think what's so great, you know, thinking about Quantum Leap is like, first of all, we have a non-binary series regular, like, boom, that's like, it's just part of the texture of the show. You know, it was groundbreaking to have me be on a sitcom, you know, in 2020. And here we are a few years later. And there are several trans series regulars, you know. In addition, we get the opportunity to tell these really groundbreaking, I think, specific, nuanced stories that are really unprecedented. And we get to do it because the network and the studio and the crew and the caterers and the designers and literally everybody senses the importance and rallies together to do the extra work that's required to set up the framework to tell the story safely, authentically, respectfully, with care. Because we know we don't get a lot of opportunities to like sling an arrow this far out. You know, it's it's, you know, back when I was growing up, they always called these like very special episodes. You know, it's like the one that like you'd watch with your family after school or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, I wanted to, like, what does that look like for our the new generation? I don't know, you know, but Quantum Leap's like primary engine is nostalgia. It always has been.
Yeah.
And so, and I know how to tap into a story that makes you feel good. And I know how to tap into, like, there's a way that you can queer something comfortable and familiar in a way that when otherwise there might be met with like someone with a guard up, it becomes just more accessible, more, I don't know, less threatening, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, not that I experience myself as threatening. I do not. But some people experience me as threatening, and I just want to dismantle that, you know, out of my community. So yeah.
When constructing those stories, like I'd be curious to like hear either a specific example or a conversation that was had either in the writer's room or like perhaps in the notes process that is like when something felt like it was not like dismantling or helping deconstruct something and where your sort of like internal compass had to like redirect and be like, actually, I think this is not this the is way. So let's try this way.
Yeah. Great example. So two episodes of Quantum Leap that tell very specific trans stories, episode 112, Let Them Play, about this trans girl on her basketball team. And then episode 2, The Family Treasure, which has this non-binary coming out scene. So the first episode, we actually had to push the episode back a whole slot because it took so much work to like massage the story and make sure that like we had consultants with GLAAD on board, we had like the studio network on board. But one of the big points was when I first sort of pitched this like day in the life of a family with a trans kid story, I got this feedback like nothing was happening. It wasn't dramatic. There weren't enough stakes. I had written on the page something that I had lived and experienced as like totally traumatic and terrifying in my teenage years. And yet it wasn't like coming through. And so then I had to write this other draft that really like mined my trauma, and I hated it. And it was a terrible experience. And then I brought it forward and we got notes on it. Like, why is this so dark and so miserable? And like, we don't want to see, we want trans joy. We want to see. And I was like, yes, that's what I wanted the whole time. So there was this like, I had to go down a whole road really of like, I knew this is not what we wanted. We're done with those narratives, right? We don't need to see more trans kids like crying and getting beaten up. We don't, you know, there's like so many of these like tropes of representation for, you know, people who are coming from the margins that we're just really trying to flip the script on. And unfortunately that time through, I had to do a rewrite that like went back to the same old script. And we all knew it was the wrong direction. And that happens in writer's rooms all the time. Like you have to sort of go down a road to realize you have to come back. This time, I mean, one, we had literally 2 weeks to put the whole episode together. But this time, there was never a, gosh, you know what would be great? Like a little more trauma for the trans character. You know, there was never even an assumption of that. There was never an ask for, in fact, there was always an understanding that what we were doing from the beginning was reframing this coming out experience and this image of binding with empowerment and liberation and, you know, freedom, like just, you know, and that as a whole, and this goes back to something you were saying earlier, I think that's when we think about the shifting nature of coming out narratives, where the conversation is really gone, you know, thankfully, is that it's an invitation in to who you are. And it's standing in your power and owning who you're meant to be. And when we model that story and we show families accepting that and we show people feeling emboldened in standing in their truth rather than ashamed and abandoned, know, we really provide a whole other timeline. Like we make it possible for people who didn't maybe think it was possible for them and to go out and do the very same thing. And that to me is like super radical.
It's so the joy of it. And like, it is contagious. Cause it like outside of the fact that they're in this particular episode, we have the Dean story and Dean coming out as non-binary. Like there's also this scene that is related to, I think a plot that is, that is for the characters in the Quantum Leap world. And I think it's a romance. And it was also modeling just like really great communication style. And I'm like, thank God, like this work is being done. This is really refreshing. And like, it reminds me of, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. We interviewed Kelly Freeman Craig, who wanted in this world where we're seeing like sex education being taken out of states and this, like we're in a very scary time. And it makes me very happy that these narratives that are showing and modeling like good, kind, human, supportive, loving things. We need it. We really need it right now.
Yeah. We have to see it to know it's possible sometimes, you know, and And I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was another scene in which there was a draft where it was really kind of an explosive blow up, you know, breakup that like triggered some toxic masculine behavior. And we were like, that's not the character we wrote. That's not the way we want to tell our story. That's not our show. And so we reframed that scene. And yeah, you know, and the way TV writing works, just for your, again, for your listeners who might not be familiar with, it's like there are so many cooks in the kitchen all the time. There's a hierarchy, like a kitchen. And
yes,
so all these
yes,
things
chef,
are,
I'd say.
Yeah, all these things are constantly being reworked from the, mm-hmm. you know, from the showrunners and the on-set producers, the writer, myself, and so, and the actors and the director. So there's so many scenes in this episode that we got to massage, you know, through the teamwork and kind of refine, which is like wild to think about how fast TV moves, and yet you can still make time for collaborative storytelling to be, you know,
a priority.
Joyful. Yeah, and a priority.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So let's dig into what it means to be a co-story editor in a writer's room on a TV show, because, you know, taking myself out of the context of what I know for TV, I think co-story editor, I like envision somebody in Adobe Premiere editing.
Yeah,
I'm like,
right,
I know
right.
that's
no.
not what it is. So yeah. what does that mean, and where do you sit in the order of how it works?
There are so many positions in a writer's room, and I don't even know if we have them all, but they rank from, like, you know, writer's assistant, showrunner's assistant, to staff writer, which is sort of considered entry level, and then story editor, executive story editor, which I am, co-producer, producer, executive producer, showrunner. I think most of them.
Yeah.
And everyone has a sort of different level of responsibility. They have a different level of seniority. They've been with the game a little longer. I came in, you know, as an actor, and I'm still, you know, my end game is still, like, you know, creating stories for me and my family to be in. So, you know, this is sort of like, I'm like having the benefit of being a part of an incredible show, and also kind of like being in grad school at the same time for TV writing and directing, which is like so great to be learning on the job. As a executive story editor, I think I come in the tier where I'm best in service in the act of collaborative storytelling, helping to ensure that there is a, you know, consistent dramatic through line in the journeys of all of our characters, and that we, you know, I'm sort of helping keep an eye on, in particular, I think Ian's track, because we have this non-binary character, but really all the series regular characters, and then the story week to week thematically, being of service to the consistency of the theme, the tone, the language, the values, I'll say,
yeah.
You know, this. So yeah, it's sort of like continuity, you know, in story, basically. So, and I think that's like where I like found my pocket in this, you know, certain writer's room. I've been in the writer's room on Transparent, the musical finale that we did for Amazon. And that was really different experience. I was also acting in that and mm-hmm. producing, and you know, there was sort of like different situations to attend to put on a movie musical as a series finale. So anyway,
it's the perfect marriage of your past and your present. It's like, let's bring the musical to the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, I love it. And I love that particular intersection, but yeah, I think, yeah. And all of the jobs are, it's like, it's all writing and it's all working for the show. Like picking out, being on set and choosing this jacket or that jacket for the actor, this line or that line, like this camera angle or that camera angle.
Oh,
it's
wow.
all writing. It's all
yeah.
telling the story, you know?
I have a very technical question. So when you are working on, say, you know, Transparent, the musical finale, and you are acting and in the room, and also, I forget exactly what you said, but maybe like
producing.
Co-producing.
Yeah.
Is your manager or agent negotiating all those roles for you? Or do you have a conversation with somebody that is in the leadership position and you're like, I can slot into these roles, so these will be my touch points? Like, what is the technical?
I mean, I'm a hustler, Gigi. I mean,
yeah.
I also know how I best serve. Like, I know where I could fit in and help the project excel. So
yeah.
I've always put myself forward, you know? With difficult people, I came in, and part of the deal, like my callback was like an hour long meeting talking and where we realized that if I were going to be an actor on the show, I should also be a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was already like bringing in, you know, dossiers of punch ups and joke ideas, you know, and the same, you know, I was running this organization I started in New York City called Musical Theater Factory. And I invited Joey Soloway and Faith Soloway to come to Musical Theater Factory to develop their musical, which became, you know, the finale. So the original cast of Amazon's Transparent was like in my theater company working on their musical, while the Tony Award winning Strange Loop that I was also developing was rehearsing next door. So, you know, I've like just been like, you need me as a producer, like, let me come in, I can help, you know? And yeah, I want to, ultimately, Martin Darrow, the showrunner, he says that I have showrunneritis. Like, I'm not going to be satisfied till I'm in charge of everything. And maybe that's true, but I'm trying to have a good time and learn everything on the way.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, you know, agents and managers will help you negotiate a contract, but, and they do generate opportunity when you are giving them momentum to like go out and do that. But I would say, thinking about my, you know, big wins in TV, aside from like, you know, auditions that were like very fortuitous, it's always been about knowing my value, seeing where I can serve, and then having the guts to say, hey, I see this area of need and I have a skill that meets that, you know, may I come on board in this capacity? Yeah. And then, you know, yeah. And then there's growth there, you know?
It sounds like something that may, again, I got my start doing theater and, you know, as a kid, you know, and
yeah, we all did. Yeah.
It's a gateway into what we're doing now, but it feels like that the spirit of that is fitting into wherever you can to bring something to life. And it's such an interesting framework for approaching television and the value that you can bring and understanding. I think it's very important for our listeners to understand the importance of what they bring to the table and being able to articulate that. I think very easily, especially in the emerging space, we can feel like we are just lucky and should be thankful and grateful that we even have the opportunity to be a writer's assistant and don't even try to do anything else, just focus on the thing and just be stuck in that box when you can be so much more.
I think for early career artists, filmmakers, of which I consider myself one still, by the way, I would say, you know, it so often seems that people around you only see you for what you're currently doing. And so you have to be in charge of how you see yourself and lean into the skills that you've developed that bring you the most joy, you know, and passion. Yeah. And like, you gotta, and it's not gonna look like just, I mean, for me, it wasn't just one job. I mean, I always dream about the one job that will integrate all the skills and passions.
When but you're it a really, showrunner.
It'll yeah, have, right. Perhaps when I'm a showrunner of that I'm also like, you know, the show I'm starring, like maybe then that I'm also directing an episode from time to time. Perhaps then, and like writing my book, perhaps then I will be, you know, content. But the point is like, yeah, take an inventory of the stuff you're good at, know your value, see yourself as multifaceted, and then show up as multifaceted. And you're going to find a lot of cool ways to continue building your skills. And literally, I mean, that's just what I'm doing. I you know, I had the opportunity to shadow Chris Grismer, who's our producing director. I got to shadow him on our season finale. And after, you know, being in the writer's room for 30 something episodes, producing two of them, directing one of them, still the opportunity to like sit behind the camera with a master director and be like, this is how he gets shit done, was like such an incredible gift. So yeah, never stop soaking it up and showing it.
Soak it up. I love that, you know, I from just your looking at your resume and IMDb alone, I'd be like, oh, Shakina knows everything and is like ready to go. But you mentioned earlier you're approaching this like your grad school, like you are learning, you're soaking it up. And I think like in all these in the conversations that we have on this podcast, it's the people that really stick with me are the ones who are like always learning and always trying to grow and always trying to figure out how they can like continue to push. And I think that is what makes the best leaders because they're also learning to work with other people in doing that and always applying that lens. I have one other specific question. And I think that this is like sometimes I'm like, is this like, I want to sort of look at how we can sort of offload the weight of telling stories about people in the queer community and creating characters who are in that outside of people who are just in that community. So, mm-hmm. so, you know, could you give me an example of like a filmmaker who is an ally and like, what are they doing that is, you know, helping create space for characters that we haven't historically seen on TV?
I mean, the first person that came to mind was Julie Klausner, who created Difficult People, mm-hmm. Who in season two introduced the role of Lola, which was this confrontational, you know, conspiracy theorist, trans truther, and was really the first time that we had seen a trans person be the teller of the joke and not the butt of the joke. And this is a while back, this is 2016, but I'm just, this experience comes to mind because I think what Julie and Scott did on that show, you know, with Billy Eichner and the rest of the incredible cast, oh my God, Cola Scola, Andrew Martin, Gabby Sidibe, Derek Baskin, I mean, just the incredible people. But they said, we're going to create a character that the world needs to see, and we don't actually know how to do that, so we're going to find someone who can help us do that, and we're going to do that. So they created a character, and they created opportunity. And they knew when to, you know, sit back and let me guide. And they also knew that it would take more space to onboard me because there were so many things about working in TV that I didn't know. And I was coming in at season two on that one. So like there was already a well-oiled machine that I was jumping into. It was terrifying. But so I would just say, you know, the allyship, the accompliship is like not just creating the space, because space without resources and support is a trap. You know, you gotta create the space, you gotta create the visibility, and then you gotta create the infrastructure to support the growth into that space.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that is one, you know, that's a shout out to Julie. I'm just like forever grateful for the, you know, chance she took on me with that. And yeah, I'm just for everyone, you know, what Martin did for me, opening the door for me to even just get my sample into Quantum Leap. I mean, that's advocacy, you know, where, and that's access where there hasn't been. So just, holding the door open for people is so, it's so powerful.
That's amazing. Well, we are reaching the end of our podcast recording time here, and we always like to wrap up with a question that is speaking to our emerging filmmaker audience.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for someone who is just getting their start in the storytelling filmmaking space?
Don't stop. Do something every day that pushes you toward your dream. And that can look different. That can be emailing someone that you're intimidated to reach out to. That could be watching that film you've always meant to watch so you can dissect that scene that everyone's talking about. It could be sitting down to write two pages of that screenplay. But just check in and say, like, every day, can I advance myself a little bit closer to the person I want to become? And you'll get there.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I can't wait to watch the season finale tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be so
more Quantum Leap. You've made a fan out of me. And please come back. We'd love to have you again on the No Film School podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Gigi. Great chatting with you.
You as well. Thank you so much, Shakina, for joining us, for being so open about your experience and your journey, and for also leaving me feeling very energized about, you know, advocating for myself as a creator. I loved that energy. I loved hearing how you sort of go in there and pitch yourself for where you see your strengths are. I think that's something we should all be remembering as we move into opportunities where we're working within a structure. How else can we contribute to this structure, to this production, to this project? You can get more No Film School at nofilmschool.com. You can like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast across all platforms. And you can also follow us on social media at No Film School. Finally, you can watch the season finale that Shakina shadowed the director on of Quantum Leap, out now on NBC or NBC.com. I don't know. Can you even get something on NBC.com these days? somebody tell me. I don't know how to do a broadcast outside of this particular episode. I'm so glad we were able to have Shakina on. I hope she comes back. And I'm a Quantum Leap fan now, guys.